All right, well, it gives me great pleasure to reconvene and introduce the next paper in what's already been a very fascinating day. And I'd like to introduce the next speaker, Dr. Geraldine Biddle-Perry, who's an associate lecturer in cultural studies at Central St. Martin's. And she's conducted research on a variety of topics related to fashion, including looking at fashion relating to class and social aspiration, the development of recreational and outdoor leisure clothes, and then kind of moving beyond the clothes textile realm to also look at hair. She co-edited the book Hair, Style, Culture, Fashion with Sarah Chang. She's also looked at cosmetics and narratives of aging skin. So lots of fascinating things there. Today, she's going to be presenting a paper entitled Fashioning Anti-Fascism, National Sporting Uniforms and Outdoor Leisure Clothing in Britain Between the Wars.
Thank you very much. So, clearly, by today and the papers we've seen, it's no longer necessary to justify the need to take fashion, textiles and dress seriously, and the arguments are now well rehearsed. The self-conscious fashioning of all and every kind of body operates as a significant set of social practices that embody assumptions around class, around race, gender, ethnicity, sexuality and so on, but also allow the possibility of the resistance and subversion of these assumptions. So my recent work, as I'm going to draw on today, has looked at the formative development of British Olympic team uniforms, which I did in the context, obviously, of the 2012 Games, and their development since the late 19th century. But it is also further focused on the Olympic Games of the 1920s and 1930s to interrogate how concepts of British sporting nationalism were given material form in the context of the wider rise of fascism and the increasing political tensions that preceded the outbreak of the Second World War. So the paper today is going to, in a sense, firstly look at this idea of how a historical model of British amateurism was embodied in the official dress of British Olympic teams and the official dress that was developed by the British Olympic Association, and to question, in a sense, the extent to which this can be seen to have operated at a symbolic and material level as a counter to the more aggressive body culture of fascist ideology. But whilst I'm going to focus on this, predominantly focus on this idea of British Olympic team uniforms and in a sense, the fashioning of British nationalism and sporting nationalism, I would like to perhaps finish if there's time and move this on to the outdoor leisure element that I want to look at, because to look at this sense of and pick up of some of the points that have been raised this morning, this idea of a non-conspicuous, non-spectacular uniformity, how does that work in this sense of Britishness and the British sporting body, but to extend this to look at some of the very politicised pacifist and anti-militarist organisations that emerged in Britain in the aftermath of the First World War. And I wanted to focus on these three interrelated youth movements very briefly. I've been looking at the way they've attempted to uniform non-uniformity and in a sense create a non-militaristic pacifist uniform. So I'm looking at the Order of Woodcraft Chivalry, established by Ernest Westlake in 1917, and two breakaway groups from the OWC, which was the Kibbukift Kindred, formed in 1920 by John Hargrave, and the Woodcraft Folk, which is probably the better known of and still extant organisation, that was established in South London in 1925 in Catford under the leadership of Leslie Paul. And this is an area of current research that has kind of developed out of my interest, in a sense, in the British, the fashion of British sporting ceremonial. So it's very much work in progress, and in a sense, it's not looking just at how anti-fascism might be fashioned, but rather, I think, as Charlotte, the first speaker, raised, was how might non-uniformity be uniformed? How can you get a collective sense of endeavour in a uniform that isn't a uniform? And that's, in a sense, what I wanted to look at. So I'm going to briefly look at how how they attempted to do that through textiles and dress, which were quite ideologically important to the way these groups identified themselves and sought to proclaim their identity. And then very briefly finish by looking at how they were also adapted to the fight against fascism in the 1930s. So they kind of changed from the 20s to the 30s. I'm going to begin with a blank slide and ask you to conjure up some images of sporting nationalism at work in the Olympic Arena in Berlin in 1936. And the first image I want you to think about is that of the idealised, muscular, tall, tanned, and blonde Aryan body of German Democratic Socialism. He stands with his arm outstretched, holding the Olympic torch. His simple, all-white athletic attire emphasises a unity of physical and ideological Olympic and nationalist purpose. But while the all-white singlet and shorts convey a sense of universal sporting endeavour linked with the idea of the Olympic mission, at the same time, this all-white outfit functions in relief to make all the more vivid the characteristic colours of Nazism, the pale brown of the shirts, the black, white and red of the flags that flutter everywhere. But then a second image of Berlin in 1936 emerges, that of a single athlete sprinting for the line, compact and muscular, brown-skinned, head down with his eyes focused on the prize, a gold medal and a laurel wreath crown, set against the backdrop of the raising of the stars and stripes. And these two models of German and American sporting nationalism were predominant in the 1930s. Many observers of the American model was very much part of the Los Angeles Games in 1932, and it was seen as the American model was seen as the epitome of progressive scientific advance and commercial enterprise that was invested, the idea of investing in a sporting body and specialisation, which was seen as the American model. And the Berlin model, even by those who opposed it, was acknowledged as a triumph of fascist propaganda. And this idea of the instrumental use of sport as a powerfully charged political force. And these models have come to dominate our image of Berlin, but they've also rendered other bodies of sporting nationalism more or less invisible. So I'm going to introduce a third mental image to the mix, and that is in the Parade of Nations as the Great Britain team enters the stadium. They enter behind France, who approach the stand where Adolf Hitler, with Goebbels at his side, raises his arm in the fascist salute. The French respond with arms similarly raised skyward, but this time in the Olympic salute, palms turned sideways, to a tumultuous welcome from the German crowd. The British team follow on, led out by three Scottish pipers and Jack Beresford in his fifth Olympiad carrying the Union flag. The team are smartly dressed in what is referred to now to by the British Olympic Association as, quote, official dress. Blue blazers, white flannels, red, white and blue striped ties and blue cricket caps for the men. The women wear white dresses with red, white and blue striped cravats and blue felt hats. Their arms as they march are firmly placed at their sides and they look resolutely ahead until, upon the command, eyes right, they sharply turn their heads towards the Führer amidst the almost total silence of the 150,000 German crowd. So what I was interested to trace was how this ubiquitous, boring team uniform is invested with lots and lots of cultural meaning, how different versions of this boring team ceremonial is invested with different versions of sporting nationalism. Since the inception of the modern Olympic movement in Athens, the opening and closing of the Games have progressively incorporated lots of different spectacular events and rituals that were always, from the moment they were introduced, seen as essentially timeless. But the rituals of the Olympics are very formative. But and these have changed considerably over the course of the 20th century. De Coubertin's utopian aim for the revival of the Games was actually for individuals from different nations to compete against each other under the shared banner of universal amateurism. So originally there was no national competition. So that in those first Games, athletes were as likely to appear in the colours of club as much as country. For example, in the orange and black jerseys of Princeton or the black and white of Boston, to which was tacked embroidered badges or armbands adorned with the national emblem. That is not to say that national identity was unimportant, rather the opposite. De Coubertin's idea was that nationalism was seen as a powerful force of that could harness a sporting esprit de corps. And he thought that nationalism was this pure spiritual force that would, in a sense, overcome the corrupting influence of commercialised sport. He thought that the perfect disinterestedness of nationalism, which sounds crazy to us, would in a sense overcome the bickering of what constituted amateurism. And ideas about this true and authentic amateur body was what drove the symbolism and rituals of early Olympicism. So contemporaneous with the inception of the modern Olympics, the society magazine Vanity Fair published a cartoon by Spy of one of Britain's finest young sporting specimens. And Spy, this is typical of the aesthetic and jokey sporting illustrations that Spy did in Vanity Fair, and they were virtually every week. So this is Wilfred Erskine Crumbo of the Oxford University Boat Club. And these figures were held up as the absolute ideal of British sportsmanship, but that stood in for sort of wider concepts of British fair play and the British nation itself. So Crumbo's, here he is, in this, he adopts this very typical nonchalant stance for picturing sportsmen, always having this one leg in front of the other, which I think is quite reminiscent of a sort of the kouros of Greek athleticism, where you had that pose of one foot in front of the other. But also with British sportsmen, there has to be an air of nonchalance, of a hand in a pocket, of this sort of casualness. So he's described by Spy as a fine young specimen of English manhood, a very well-built young fellow of much symmetry and proportion. His achievements on and off the sporting field are matched by the remarkable peculiarities of his appearance, a beautiful complexion, an almost girlish look, a very frequent blush, which is the outcome of much modesty, a temper that will bear much chaff, and a chin that in times of depression looks as though it would fall off and explode on the floor. So this is this typical idea of British sportsmanship and fair play. So for a unified... Oh, we haven't got to that bit yet. Okay, so originally you had this idea of nationalism as this sort of pure thing where individual athletes would compete, not as part of a team, but just they financed themselves. But by 1907, this began to change, and new rules were introduced that said that individuals could participate only as part of a national team. So by the London Games of 1908, we're beginning to have the first ceremonial rituals that we'd recognise today. And so there was the first parade of nations. Every athlete taking part in the parade was expected to be attired in, quotes, the athletic costume of his country or of the sport in which he intends to compete, unless it was raining, whereupon suitable attire was left entirely to the discretion of the manager of each team. So, i.e., anything really went. There was just sort of virtually everything was thrown in the mix. But this idea of athletes appearing in their own, the sporting attire, was in a sense the legacy of de Coubertin's aim. He saw that each country had their own special sporting specialism that reflected not just the sporting idea, but their culture as well, that somehow nations had characteristics and special skills. So the French were renowned for their fencing, the Hungarians for wrestling. The British, of course, were renowned for being, you know, all-rounders, good at everything, or not very good at everything, you know, whichever way you want to think. So in a sense, that's the legacy of that. So we've got the parade of nations, so there's now national teams, but they're still appearing in actual sporting attire rather than an official team uniform. That's not quite emerged yet. So in 1908, the Australian swimming team, despite the vagaries of the British weather, appeared in swimming costumes and caps, some with bare feet. The teams of Finland, Norway and Sweden were notable for the neatness of their nautically inspired all-white gymnastic costume with matching white soft-brim hats. The Daily Mail described the Germans and Holstein lines dressed entirely in navy blue and their mechanical high-stepping movement, which made it kind of more impressive. The Italians, white knickerbocker breeches with military-style jackets and flat straw hats. French team, military kepis, figure-hugging white jerseys and twill breeches with knee-length boots. And the USA squad, although it had a squad of 122, only, according to one source, only 15 turned up in the actual parade. And there was a lot of controversy about the flags, and they were very miffed with us. And so that might be why there was a lesser. And whilst they were given suits, matching suits to wear, on the voyage over, etc., on the day they opted for ordinary leisure attire with knickerbocker and lounge suits worn with a blue cap with the stars and stripes. So the British team were compelled for the first time to compete under the banner of the United Kingdom, and athletes from the four home nations who came in last were led out by, quotes, an Oxford blue, a Cambridge blue, and a former member of the ET8, wearing their respective club blazers and trim shorts. But there was a sense of aesthetic and national uniformity achieved with the addition of a white peak cricket cap adorned with a Union flag that was worn by all. Rather than seeking to obscure the potential conflicts of national interest among these four home nations, sports historian Richard Holt argues that the bodies of these sportsmen exploited a cocktail of cultural forces that was synthesised in the idealised figure of the gentleman amateur, of which Crumbo was kind of the representative image. Holt argues that this synthesis allowed supporters and competitors the opportunity to affirm their affiliation with both the cultural nation and the federal nation that Olympic competition now required. In 1908, club and country came together in the figure of this athletic, manly hero that by now was an elemental part of popular cultural representation. If I just go back to the... And the popular press very quickly in 1908 picked up on this idea of using costume linked to particular characteristics. But they used this kind of... There's this weird miss, as Hobsbawm would have, of this invention of tradition where you pick up on a particular version of the past and reinvent it through myth and ritual. So they use this kind of the myths of antiquity to unify conflicting ideas of nationhood that are expressed in costume. And that these costumes, especially the more bizarre, the better, to have this idea of Olympic universalism, but at the same time these constantly operate to make clear differences within and between different types of national sporting bodies. So the Olympic opening ceremony encouraged a wide variety of interpretations that gave material form to this idea of utopian sporting camaraderie and these positive and negative associations. Benedict Anderson's seminal discussion of the construction of nationhood makes it clear it's not what form nationalist ideas might or might take, but the ways in which an imagined community of national identities are symbolically clothed in the national, in the imagination. And this is a picture from Stockholm in 1912. So by Stockholm, we're beginning to see the idea of there being an official ceremonial uniform. And there's beginning to be these different types of sporting uniformity that are marked out through clothing. Of competitive attire for the track, warm up and warm down clothing, so the beginnings of track suits. And Americans were right since, you know, the 1890s, I think, in Paris. There's a sort of little discussion of how poor they thought the Europeans, how far they were behind in terms of waiting to compete. The Europeans wore sort of great Macintoshes, while the Americans had their own sort of special sort of warm-up robes, and they saw the Europeans as sort of, you know, complete Luddites on the track. So Americans were at the forefront of this idea of having a specialist athletic body. So they were devoted to specialisation, i.e. that you would sort out the event you were best at, and you would focus on that, and you would have a special trainer, and you would have special... So you have special events, special bodies, and then beginning to have special types of clothing to match this kind of specialisation. Now, what happens in this idea of having the same but all seeing each other's differences is that there was very much this idea that national characteristics were also embodied, these sort of negative and positive. So as Britain tends to be losing its power, in a sense, beginning to decline, both on a world in a political stage, but also, you know, on the track, everyone's getting better at than us. You know, we invented it, but we're losing. So Britain is beginning to worry about how exactly they want to present themselves in this new arena. So Theodore Cook, who competed and who was head of the BOA, BOC as it was then, began to question why we might be losing on the track. But there was always this belief that we were disadvantaged because, as a nation, much more importance was attached to games rather than athletics. And when we did win, unlike the Americans or the Germans, this was the result of an authentic natural talent rather than either American hothousing or the obsessional tendencies of sort of Germanic, you know, physical regimes. So Theodore Cook, talking about how to appear, or how people appeared in the ceremony, said, "Few of us would care to see England take its games quite in the American spirit, and the admiration which we feel for these splendid bands of Scandinavian gymnasts is not unmingled in the case of most of us with a certain shamed contempt." Whilst we, in a sense, despise these other teams, we then had to address how our team would begin to look in this modern age. And when in Stockholm in 1912, when the USA appeared, they really raised the bar by having this very slick... It was 400 strong team, so it was a huge team that they... So in physical, just in physical size, it was impressive because of the amount of athletes were competing and the range of athletic events that they could send. But it was impressive because it was very slick. So they had these white flannels and blue blazers and these boaters that they, as they went past the royal box, they clasped the boaters to their chest. And it was seen as very impressive. And in effect, this kind of set the sort of ceremonial aesthetic. But the British took their sport seriously, but what they now had to consider was quite how they were to be seen to be taken seriously in this new age. So part of the problem was this idea of representing British amateurism. The BOA was always hindered by this idea of avoiding both mass regimentation, which was seen as the German model, so this idea of having everyone the same. They wanted a sense of individualism. So if we think of Crumbo with his hand in his pocket, there was always this sense that the British sportsman had to be nonchalant. And if you ever, you know, seen Chariots of Fire, you've got Nigel Havers with the butler setting up the champagne glasses. and then lighten his cigar when he'd cut. So there was always this element that British sportsmen had to be not trying too hard. And you didn't want this idea of regimentation, so you had to have a sense of individualism. On the other hand, you had the American model, which was seen as very commercialised and sort of commodified, that went against with this idea of British amateurism, of the gentleman player who could pay his own way. So British teams, I mean, by the 1920s, most other European teams were, and other, you know, international teams were being financed by some sort of government investment in the teams. But because of this huge, you know, moral panic about what constituted amateurism, and you might have people, once you've got people, the state investing in it, then you're going to have people running who couldn't afford to pay their way. So British amateurism was very strict about monetary concerns, so that the team was always financed by public donations. And in a sense, that became a mantra of British sense of how a sporting uniformity should be outfitted. So they were always mighty mean about how they were going to what they were supplying, and it virtually governed who could compete for a long time. In the 1920s and 30s, Britain was not unaware of the growing ideological and economic investment that the USA and fascist Europe were making in sport, and the ways they were spectacularly fashioning their new kinds of sporting bodies. However, with its foundation in the concept of amateurism, based on the ability to pay one's own way, British sporting nationalism not only prioritised the ideological over the economic. In a sense, this idea of eschewing any financial gain and eschewing any sense of spectacle was the means by which, in a sense, a belief in the idea of what it was to be British was how this idea was sustained and then embodied in clothing. So I think it's quite interesting to situate this with some of the earlier papers and this idea of this. Nationalism hasn't been mentioned so far, but they've all been focused on British emanations of uniforms. And I think there's something to be said about the desire of British uniforms to have a non-spectacular sense of Britishness, but in uniform. So I think there's some parallels to be drawn with the uniforming of the British national sporting team and British militarism in a sense as well. And this idea of having a kind of, not a dullness, but the valorisation of dullness, that dullness becomes a British symbol in itself, that's allied to this idea of a higher form of winning, that we might not lose on the track, but we always win ideologically. And in a sense, this dullness takes on, I think, a new ideological salience with the rise of fascism. Early in 1927, the British Olympic Journal reported on how preparations for the Amsterdam Games the following year were being globally anticipated as a venue for national showboating. There was news that the USA had already amassed $500,000 for training and equipment, and that this had awakened keen jealousy in Germany. Here, national subscription lists had been initiated, and the German Olympic Association and the German National Executive for Physical Culture, it was reported, was presenting each donor of 10 marks or more with a gilt Olympic pin as a token of gratitude. The article continued, "France's training has almost a military aspect, as we learn that Olympic winners are to be awarded the Cross of the Legion of Honour. Italy, where Mussolini has taken upon himself the post of supervisor extraordinary for all athletic doings, that may enhance Italy's reputation at home and above all abroad, is teeming with sportive activities. Sweden and Finland are already assured of sufficient amounts to carry them through all necessary courses and expenditure. And from Japan to the Argentine, from Austria to Estonia, the continent's old and new are hives of unprecedented hustle, all with that one great aim, Amsterdam. When the BOA was preparing for the British team's appearance in Amsterdam, they issued strict instructions about not being able to pay for laundry, to wear slippers when possible, not to wear the shoes out, and basically very they were so worried and about having this sort of showy body, and so the BOA said, we want to provide sufficient funds, but we need to assure the British public that in those events in which Great Britain is to be represented, the principles of true amateurism have in no way been sacrificed. And the overall cost of kitting out the British team was £754.13.11. And there was a further £171.17.08 expended on technical equipment, i.e. swimming suits, cycling vests, and some Union Jack flags. Basically, the team uniforms stayed more or less the same throughout from about from 1924 onwards. There was always huge discussions on variations on the embroidery on the pocket badges. So, for instance, in 1928, it was decided that each blazer would have the particular discipline they were competing in embroidered. But then there was queries about that if you were in a discipline that had a lot of letters, then obviously that would cost a lot more. So they were kind of, they then dropped that by 1932. Concepts of British amateurism and fair play, rooted in the discourse of 19th century imperialism, were the lodestone of British sporting nationalism and a nascent Olympic movement. This gave credence to the belief that the authenticity and true nature of both were embodied in the figure of the traditional all-round sporting hero. And there was some credence to this because Arnold's reform of the public school was very much the influences that de Coubertin drew upon when he was trying to sort of formulate the modern games. The functional neutrality of competitive and non-competitive sporting clothing validated a belief in the neutrality of the bodies that occupied them. But I would argue that it is the very ubiquity of ceremonial clothing that emphasises the power of national sporting bodies to at one and the same time reinforce concepts of conformity and yet at the same time reveal cleavages within and between different kinds of bodies. So this quote from Paul Fussell says, "No matter how humble or supposedly inconsequential, no form of uniform or official dress just materialises out of the blue. Everyone is the product of prolonged thought, not just about the mission of the group being outfitted, but about the meanings associated with its cultural function and authority." So while the British uniform was decidedly dull, it was a very self-conscious dullness that necessitated constant negotiation and renegotiation about how it would quite be performed. One of the things that I'm quite interested in, people talking about hats, is how much work, the variety of different hats that appeared at each games. And I think hats are a very under-researched area of fashion and dress history, because in a sense, if you look at the actual culture of fashion, then for a large proportion right up until sort of the 1950s, then what hat you wore was of extreme importance, and the way hats were used is, I think, very important. Right, so leading up to the 1936 Berlin Olympics, British fears about international sporting competition were historically consistent in being equally balanced between the threats posed by Nazism and the wider erosion of British concepts of amateurism. The political dimensions of both were inextricably intertwined, but as a result of such ambiguity, they continued to be more implicitly worried at than explicitly attacked. In a humorous feature in 1934, the newly designed Olympic poster for the Winter Games to be held in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in 1936 provides a focus for the debate in the British BOJ. The feature satirically asks, of this figure on the left. What does he grasp? And invites readers for suggestions as to just what the skier might be holding in his right hand while offering a kind of variety of a few of their own. Now, winter sports were never likely to figure high on a British sporting agenda. They had nevertheless assumed quite a wide significance in the strained atmosphere of international politics in the 1930s, and particularly with Germany's return to Olympic competition in 1928, and this is when the first Olympics were held in Semmeritz. So in this poster, a sort of very Aryan sense of Germanness is epitomised in this figure of the male skier that was the aesthetic that very much kind of influenced the 36 Olympics from the German nationalist point of view. So the feeling of bronze statuary and this kind of very chiselled look and looking steadfastly, mystically skywards towards the mountain tops. What I quite liked about this in the way it appeared in the British Olympic Journal was having these two competing models again, where you had this you know, German skier and sort of Nietzschean super god, and then on the right you had the British athlete, a strong finish after drinking his Horlicks, which I think it's a nice counterbalance. But I think what this demonstrates is that even by 1934, the growing awareness within British, not just within the British sporting fraternity, but in the wider political scene, of poking fun at this sense of Germanness and countering it with a kind of British model of not just ineptitude, but of this idea of a higher form of winning, which dominates discussions in the British Olympic Journal, particularly leading up to each Olympic Games. There's always this discussion, shall we compete? Because, you know, we're the only team that really plays fair, or the rest of the world does all these other things, that's why they win, should we? But, oh, we have to, we invented it, of course we have to. We're the only people that have this true, you know, spirit of Olympicism. So there's always much discussion of that. So this is the 1936 Olympic cap, and it's got the rings on. And the rings were introduced in the 36 Olympics. They were the Olympic flag was raised in 1924 with the rings, but in a sense, the Nazi Olympics was the ones that really introduced the rings and the flame and lots of other rituals. Martin Polley argues it's important to recognise the ways in which amateurism itself was an ideology of British state thinking. An updated version of traditional mantra of public school sporting laissez-faire was harnessed to a concept of voluntarism that was highly influential in shaping opinion at home, particularly after Munich. Individual sporting enterprise and winning against the odds served to emphasise the autonomy of Britain and the British people in the face of the, quote, machine-like aggression of fascism. And that's constantly used, that machine analogy, and the growing economic dominance of the USA. In response to Hitler's increasingly obvious propagandist use of sport, the British government was at pains to continue to display a hands-off policy, emphasising that the BOC was a private organisation, and there was a strict rule of abstention maintained at the Foreign Office. With the benefit of hindsight, this might seem ill-judged and politically weak, but can also, as Peter Beckby argues, be seen as an alternative, politically motivated strategy of ideological intervention. This mirrored wider cultural understandings of what it was to be British and embodied these wider understandings of sporting nationalism. I think it's interesting that they reverted to the cap in 36. It wasn't worn again for a number of years. But I think the cap encapsulated at that point in 36 this return to a kind of more traditional sense of British sporting, 19th century sporting nationalism. Ironically, one could argue that the very spectacular presentation of Nazi sporting ambition in Berlin, in a sense, created a perfect setting in which the very dullness of British sporting ceremonial attire stood out as an absolute definite response to this ideology. So that's kind of where I left my research on the Olympics, but I've got a few minutes just to briefly raise these issues that I've kind of broadened this idea to look at, in a sense, this idea of how do you counter, when you're looking at uniforms, how do you counter the fascist element, the militarist element? And so I've looked at various emanations of this in Britain between the wars. And we were talking earlier on Laura's paper with this idea of cutting down shorts. And I was interested in this idea of appropriation. We tend to think of that with subcultural style, where but pacifist clothing or this idea of using military clothing as a form of pacifism. We tend to think of that after the Second World War with CND and the sort of the navy duffel coats and the 60s, the counterculture using military, and after the Second World War with leather jackets, you know, to appropriate military clothing to actually, you know, fight as a form of pacifism. So I was interested in how this might be linked with the First World War. I've been looking at army surplus, the records of army surplus after the First World War, which is quite interesting because there were these huge depots full of army surplus clothing. And there's some evidence to support. Well, there's big lists. You could buy virtually anything on army surplus, from a battleship to huts to furniture to prosthetics, virtually anything that they had. But there's also evidence of them reusing all the cloth, of re-dyeing the cloth that they had to be made up. That you know, obviously there was a shortage of cloth, and they re-dyed it in darker colours and tried to use it that way. But also there's I've got some adverts of what they're called leisure suits for golf that were obviously some kind of factory suiting that was used, and they were trying to be resold as these sort of leisure suits after the war. So there's masses of information. There was a weekly auction of army surplus. So I was quite interested in how khaki shorts, the popularity of khaki shorts in the interwar years, might have emanated from this idea of appropriation and of countering militarism with a kind of a sense of subversion, of subverting one thing to reformulate it. So I've looked at that, but also shorts are particularly important as seen as this radical form of dress that was used in different ways. And also the idea of how do you uniform non-uniformity. So this is the Order of Woodcraft Chivalry. Now they wouldn't call it uniform, they called it costume. And Paul Fussell has this idea of the differences between uniform and costume. He says something like uniform would be a uniform requires a leader and some followers and a sense of purpose, and costume is just something you're kind of playing at. I don't know if that necessarily is true, but in a sense, these different things I'm looking at use the same. It's the idea of using the same clothes, the same symbols, but using them in different ways. So in a sense, in the Olympic arena, everyone's using the same kinds of clothes with different and the same forms of symbols to represent different things. But these versions also use a different sense of nationalism, this idea of a folk culture that became an important part of the pacifist movements after the 1920s, of this idea of fashioning a new kind of modern body, sort of aesthetically and culturally. So they returned to sort of a medieval, it was sort of anti-capitalist, pacifist, anti-militarist So they didn't want buttons, they had lacings. And in a sense, they attempted to overcome this idea of uniformity by encouraging the autonomy of people making their own uniforms. So this is the Order of Woodcraft Chivalry. These are two followers. And they had this weird mix of languages of Anglo-Saxon, and it's very much based on the Red Indian woodcrafting movement by Seton in America. And the Vondervogel had its elements as well. But the British movement was this weird mix where they were given Indian names, and they had all these sort of tribal dances and very, very strict ideas about how to costume. But again, sandals were important. They had sandals and leather soled. So here is the great keeper of the honours, Tally, Great Bear. And Indian names were chosen. And they had to wear shorts and tunics. So it was very much linked to the idea of men's dress reform as well, of freedom. He's in sort of Rottingdean High Street, I believe, there. And this is his sort of cohort, Grey Squirrel, who's in a hempen tunic of medieval design, worn with bare legs and sandals and sort of these long plaits, Anglo-Saxon style. They basically set up all these rituals, invented rituals, of a kind of English folk culture. And there was this much wider move in the 20s towards of an invented folk tradition. And when we saw that simplified dress, part of the problem with English folk culture is that, in terms of dress, was that there has to be quite a lot of discussion because no one could quite really work out what English folk dress would look like. So they, in a sense, this idea Georgina Boyce says about the village in the mind in the 1920s, of this idea of this recreated folk culture that fed into these various youth movements. So this is a breakaway group, the Kibbukif Kindred, formed by John Hargrave, who wrote an important polemic called The Great War Brings It Home. And what the Great War brought home for John Hargrave was that men enfeebled by city life, that forced to live in the trenches had kind of had made them into sort of hard and muscular types who could survive. And so that he thought then that if that could be recreated in civilian life, you know, you would have this new breed, this new Anglo-Saxon race. So they had to make their own dress and tunics, and they were decorated with various sort of motifs. And this is the woodcraft folk. Again, lots of instructions of how these tunics should be. The woodcraft folk, they were very much linked to the cooperative movement. So there was a sort of radical socialism involved in this. So I'm rushing through this because I'm just sort of raising this as where I'm sort of going with things. This is a woodcraft wedding, 1930, Lily Chandler and Richard Goss, in an article in the Wheat Sheaf, the Journal of the Royal Cooperative Society. The pair looked remarkably bright and cheery in the costumes of the woodcraft folk. His was a green Robin Hood jerkin, leather fringed and belted with embroidered leather, worn with green shorts, woolen stockings and stout walking shoes. The bride's ensemble was exactly the same, that she had a green knee-length skirt and made a concession to orthodoxy by carrying a bouquet of buttercups, whose yellow hue accentuated the fairness of her rich, uncovered, shingled hair. Junior woodcrafts formed a guard of honour outside the church with their totem poles, and the reception was held at near Hedgemow, the bride's family home, before the couple left on a hike walking tour of Germany. This, in the 1930s, these utopian ideals and the idea of costume became a kind of real problematic for the woodcraft folk. And they felt, because of the Public Order Act, people weren't allowed to wear uniforms, so they had to struggle with whether they would get rid of the uniform or not. And it was decided that what they wouldn't quite get rid of the uniform, but they would get rid of the part of the constitution that said they had to wear the uniform. So what they decided to in the 1930s was to have people wear these shorts. Well, they always wore shorts, but this blue shirt, which was seen as a marker of respect for the smashed socialist youth movements of the continent, and they felt that all their efforts had to go into fighting fascism. An interesting thing about the shorts of the woodcraft folk, they had to be shorter than everyone else's. So they had these, what they called abbreviated style of shorts that were extremely short. And I think there was an element of internationalism that those shorts were seen as much more like a continental, because they would wear sort of Anglo-Basque berets as well and have these very short shorts. It was a sort of almost mark of their sort of the internationalism that kind of underwrote their radical socialism. I haven't got a picture of the Social Credit Union and the green shirts, which is where the Kibokif kindred went. And they were a much more extremist group, and they described themselves as the green-clad shock troopers of the People's Fighting Front. And they were quite radical. And I think John Hargrave fired an arrow into someone's window as sort of, he was quite a sort of a radical. This is just kind of a summary of where I'm going with my idea of uniform in British non-uniformity and individuality. That how do you kind of uniform collectivity at the same time maintain this sense of British individualism?